Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. Good morning. Hello. Welcome to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, campus community radio from Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast on the unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, Stolo, Catesy, Coquitlam, and other Coast Salish peoples. My name is Jesse, your host for this morning. I'm joined in studio by Craig and Nina. Hello.
Hello.
We are going to, we are going to have a conversation about a whole bunch of things, including Nina's research. But first, as usual, we are going to start the show off with a little bit of local music. And I am going to take the opportunity to play a track by CJSF alumna Hallelujah Hailu, who is blowing up and very quickly is going to become too popular for us to play on this radio station. So I'm going to take advantage of the moment and play her latest single, which is called Manic Pixie Pacifist, right here on CJSF on Speak Up.
Don't call me and expect anything other than my usual apathetic tone. But you confess it on me. Who else knows? Maybe I'm just a manic pixie pacifist. Act real, the life that you believe in. Just a step in your character development. Was I just playing a role and you were taking me home?
Pixie Pacifist by Hallelujah Hailu here on Speak Up on CJSF 90.1. Now I'm going to let Craig take it away for our interview with Nina Uhl.
Hi, thanks, Jesse.
Our interview today is with Nina Houle, an MA student in the SFU Global Humanities. She is working on a thesis right now entitled I Sing of Dice and the Board, Tabletop Games and the Ancient Mediterranean. So, Nina, what is your MA thesis about in a little more detail?
Oh, glad you asked. So I work with a theoretical thing that's called classical reception or ancient Mediterranean reception. It's kind of like meta history. I'm not actually studying ancient history. I'm studying how later cultures, in my case, sort of late 20th and 21st century geek culture, use and perceive and engage with ancient history. So lots of people do this kind of work with film. They might study things like 300 or Gladiator, that kind of media. I'm studying board games. So, you know, you might be familiar with titles like Settlers of Catan or Carcassonne, that kind of board game that usually has a historical theme, doesn't always. I have a sample section of games that are all set in Greece or set in ancient Rome, and then some of them are set in fantasy settings that are based on Greek mythology.
Okay, so it's not, you know, this isn't like the Monopoly or the Risk type thing.
Oh, yeah. No.
So these are games like all about Greek, Italian, basically all around the Mediterranean.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, largely because my background is in Hellenic studies, I actually did a certificate of Hellenic studies here at SFU when I was in undergrad. My focus is mostly on ancient Greek and ancient Roman culture, but sometimes other parts of the ancient Mediterranean sneak in there. Like I have a few games that I study that incorporate ancient Egypt, for example.
Oh, cool. So when it comes to board games, have you found any history of like societies back then playing these kind of board games, and was that an influence at all?
Oh, absolutely. The oldest known board game is 5,000 years old, and it was found in present-day Iraq. And people were probably playing games before that, and they've been playing games ever since. The truth is, I haven't really studied historical board games in that much detail. The oldest games I work with are from like the 70s or the 80s. Most of them actually date back to the 21st century. Feels funny to say date back when they're 15 years old, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
That being said, if there's any game designers out there who want to look at games from ancient Rome or ancient Greece and make a little update, that would be so cool and I would love to play it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure there's probably a boss somewhere with a bunch of depicting a bunch of people playing, you know, card games or three-card Monty or something.
There's a really famous ancient Greek vase that depicts two characters from the Iliad. It's Ajax and Achilles, two of the heroes, and they're playing this board game with little pieces. It kind of looks like chess.
Oh, interesting. And interesting you bring up the Iliad, because the Iliad is a very famous piece of literature, considered the first European large-scale literary, for lack of a word, thing. With board games being like a competition between people, does that relate to that era at all, just in the era of like, you know, competition and war that is often known amongst the various factions throughout history there?
100%. Lots of the games that are coming out today or that have come out within the last 20 years are based on famous wars from that period in history. There's lots of games where you can play as generals in kind of the Alexander the Great era in the Hellenistic period, or you can play as their rivals. You can play as the Persians, which is super fun. Lots and lots of Roman-themed games will have a military focus where it's like Romans versus barbarians, or maybe a Roman civil war, that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, that would make sense in terms of making a good game, because, you know, I think I think we all have the sense of wanting to beat our fellow competitors in
100%.
Gaming situations.
Funnily enough, a lot of other games will still be competitive, but they don't have a military focus, which is cool because, you know, lots of what we know about the ancient world is war. We get a lot of archaeological written records that are based on battles. But, you know, just like now, people back then weren't, it wasn't everyone was going to war all the time. And the games actually reflect that pretty nicely. There's a lot of games that are based on building or based on trade, and they're still competitive. You're still trying to win, but instead of trying to kill off your enemies, you're trying to like make more money than them or build a better temple than them, something like that.
Yeah, well, one of the games that you mention on in your thesis is actually a game that isn't like about war. It's The Downfall of Pompeii.
And, my favorite.
Okay. So what do you like about that one specifically?
Well, it takes place during one of my personal favorite points in history. I think it takes place in Pompeii in the years leading up to 79 CE, which, as some of you probably know, was the year that the volcano Mount Vesuvius erupted. The city was buried in ash, turned it into one of the best archaeological sites in the world. And in this game, you play as citizens of Pompeii trying to flee the volcano as it engulfs the city in lava. So if you win, you're alive, you get to live your life. If you die, there's a bit of a consolation because one day your bones will be dug up and people are going to learn a lot about ancient Rome from your dead remains.
Everybody wins.
That's a bit morbid, but archaeology is a bit morbid, let's be real.
In that situation, for me, I'd hope I wouldn't be on the chamber pot at the time the volcano went through. But one, in your presentation, you play you have a sort of like game piece thing. Is there a way we can game piece sort of interactive function? Is there a way we could do that on the show here?
Sure. So, for context, I've sometimes done my thesis work, you know, in person or over video. And when I do that, I like to show people pieces of the games I work with. But we don't have a visual on radio. But what I'm going to do, Craig, is take a piece from one of the games I study, and I'm going to pass it to you. And you are going to, just in some broad strokes, describe what you see, what on this particular game piece is interesting, and do you have any guesses as to what kind of ancient civilization it might be trying to show?
Well, my history of that period is not as versed as yours, but I'm seeing what looks like a woman, probably from Egypt. She has, you can see the kind of iris eye on a pot there. And the next one, I see someone probably from a more Middle Eastern area. It's a old man who's holding a couple of rugs.
Mm-hmm.
I would guess Persian rugs. Another one looks like a Greek man. It's a heavyset fellow with grapes and a vase. The next one is a woman, I would say Italian. Looks like she's carrying olives and olive oil, although that could be Greek too. And the next one is a goat. I don't know what the goat is from, but maybe I'll just say North Africa for the added region.
I appreciate you incorporating North Africa, underrated part of the ancient world. Mm-hmm. So the piece of that's actually the main scoreboard for a game, which the game is called Corinth. It's a dice rolling game where you play as merchants and you're trying to. You're from all over the Mediterranean. So the little people on the board represent the players, and they all do come from different cultures, as you described quite nicely. And they've gathered in this one town, Corinth, which is a real place in Greece. And you are trying to outroll and outmaneuver and outgain your opponents, and basically have the most productive trade weekend, if you will. So that's one of the games that's set in a peacetime, and you are foxy merchants trying to gain capital and to kind of outpace each other. It's a very tricksy sort of game.
Yeah, sounds like a game a lot of capitalists would love. Although when you look at board games, a lot of them actually have a lot of capitalist themes, but that goes off topic.
There's all, that's a whole deep dive. There's all kinds of interesting scholarship about different economic models in games.
Yeah. Monopoly is a big game for a reason.
Oof, tell me about it.
Yeah. So this game is Corinth, you said?
It is, yes. I have the board in front of me right here, and it has the same little people who are on the scoreboard on the cover art, and they're kind of gathered together in this very ancient Greek-looking locale. It has olive trees. You can see, like, columns, a bunch of temples. It's kind of an interesting starting point for looking at the way games as a whole portray the ancient Mediterranean, because it's got a lot of really classic ancient hallmarks. Like, you see them and you instantly know where and when in history we're supposed to be.
Yeah, and is there a winner in this game, or is it just whoever can accumulate the most capital?
Yeah, it's whoever accumulates the most goods.
Okay. Sounds fun. It would be a real pick-me-up, considering in my life capital is always very elusive.
Oh, tell me about it. I'm a grad student.
you definitely know. We talked about Downfall of Pompeii, which is one of the games you've chronicled here, but there are also some others, too, like Seven Wonders. When I looked up this one, it kind of felt like Sims Ancient Greece. How did that factor into your thesis?
I would say it's less Sims and more Civilization. Mm-hmm. Each player controls a city-state, and then you have to develop the city-state. There's all sorts of different ways you can do that. You can build armies and fight other people and get points for that, or you can choose a more peaceful route and become like a merchant empire and do trading, and then you can also gain points. This is really interesting from an archaeological point of view. You gain points by accumulating culture. Mm. So if you have a city with a lot of philosophers, with a lot of artists, with a lot of great architects in it, you can gain victory points which help you win. And it kind of, the implication there is kind of you're doing things that will make your city be remembered.
Oh, cool. And if one of your cities is Venice, you're doing all that while also contemplating that you're sinking into the sea.
Yes. Luckily, this is set in the Hellenistic period, so this is before Venice. I think Venice was a fishing village at that point in time.
Yeah, well, hindsight would have probably been helpful there. Another game that I found you talked about was a game called Minotaur. And
yes.
Yeah. And when I looked at this, the entire concept seems like, it's about trying to slay a minotaur, which sounds pretty cool. Oh, is there anything more to that?
Oh, 100%. Minotaur is a really interesting example. We were talking about competitive games earlier. Minotaur is cooperative. So either all the players win or all the players lose. It's also interesting because it's one of those fantasy games I was talking about. It's not set anywhere that's in the historical record. It's based on Greek mythology. So, there are connections to history, of course. The Minotaur is an ancient creature who shows up in a lot of artwork and a lot of ancient Greek stories. But, it's not real.
Yeah.
As far as we know,
you're not going to actually go to the island of Crete and get attacked by a roving Minotaur.
If you see what it's like when I wake up in the morning, you might think there are Minotaurs in real life. Not a good
sign. Fair
enough.
But yeah, it kind of speaks to a big trend, not just in board games, but in pop culture as a whole, where specifically when we think about and when we deal with ancient Greece, when we make pieces of culture that are based on ancient Greece, we're more likely to draw from mythology than we are from actual history. And that's not necessarily the case with a lot of other ancient civilizations. Like, think about popular things that you might have seen that are based on Rome, like something like Gladiator or Total War. They might have some elements that are inaccurate or that are made up, but they're fundamentally based on something that actually happened and people who really existed. Whereas a lot of Greece-based media, stuff like Percy Jackson, something like the video game Hades, they're all based on mythology. You get an exception once in a while, something like 300 or Alexander. Those are very, very loosely based on actual history. But the vast majority of Western pop culture, including Western board games, deal with Greece as this kind of magical, mythological place. And I think that's something super interesting that's come through in my research. And Minotaur is a great example of that. It's pure fantasy. It's really fun.
Yeah, sounds like it. You mentioned Gladiator there. I actually saw a post this morning from Russell Crowe, and he said, taking my kids to see my old office. And it's a picture of him and his kids in front of the Colosseum.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Are you not entertained?
Yep, that was the joke also said on it, to his kids. Yeah, so I guess you're excited for the upcoming sequel to that.
I'll be in the theaters.
Yeah, definitely. Sounds interesting. So I wanted to talk also a bit about the process of doing a thesis for an MA, because I had a teacher a couple semesters ago, and he said, don't get an MA because there's so much research that goes into it that no matter how hard you work, it never feels like enough. Is that the case with your thesis?
100%. Although I did come in with a bit of an advantage, which is that I did an undergrad honors paper. Depending on which undergrad program you're doing, you might have the option to do an honors. I definitely suggest it if you feel really connected to whatever you're studying, whether that be history or English lit, anything like that. I believe there are honors programs in sciences too, but I can't speak to that. My training is entirely in humanities. So I did go into grad school already having done a bit of research on this particular topic. And I think it's given me a really big advantage because I didn't have to spend any time thinking about what I was going to research and trying to narrow down my topic, which I see a lot of my colleagues, my sort of co-students doing that right now, where they're trying to fine-tune what they're doing. Definitely, if you are thinking about grad school, do be prepared. It is a lot of work. But you really get to tailor your work to your passions and really work with what you think is interesting. And that's been an absolutely life-changing opportunity for me, just to spend all my time doing something that I really love and that I think is really, really interesting, and to be part of a community that also who also think what I'm doing is interesting. That's been incredibly fulfilling. Despite all of the work that I have to put in, I think my mental health has never been better. We'll see if that changes once I'm in my second year and I have to actually work on writing this whole thing. But right now, while I'm just reading and taking notes, I'm in a great place.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that you hadn't started the writing process yet.
Well, I've been taking notes and I have an outline kind of, but I haven't started fleshing out any of the pointers. That's a second year thing. For what it's worth, I'm in a 2-year Master's of Arts program. Just finished the first year.
Okay, that's good to know. It's interesting to know about the English Lit History honors stuff, because I'm in both those and I'm considering the honors program myself.
Oh,
so
do it. Even if you don't go on to grad school, it's such a cool experience.
Yeah, well, it depends on if my grades can get up past the threshold there, you know.
Of course.
But it would be nice. Let's see. Don't have any other questions listed, but I'm sure I can come up with something.
I got a question.
Sure.
And, I mean, you've sort of, through the conversation, I've got I have maybe figured out the answer myself, and maybe listeners have as well, but why board games specifically?
Great question. I mean, I think they're cool. Mm-hmm. That's the
clearly.
Really short answer.
Yeah.
But they're also vastly understudied,
mm-hmm.
Especially the sort of reception and portrayal angle that I'm taking on. Most of the existing academic scholarship on board games is either from like an education point of view,
mm-hmm.
You know, like board games teaching kids about probability or literacy or whatever, spatial awareness, that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
or it's from a design or theoretical perspective where, like, a lot of mathematicians write about board games because of all of the chance
the
and probability
and,
elements. Yeah. A lot of, like, STEM engineer type people love the kind of mechanic element.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot less of a sort of arts and humanities point or social sciences point of view where people are looking at how games portray aspects of the human condition, and that can move beyond history. Like,
mm-hmm.
people could look at games that portray modern situations and examine them from a sociology point of view. So in some ways, I kind of feel like I'm in this untapped frontier, which is super cool.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I imagine even, like, most research on board games that is focusing on, like, how they portray on the less, like, mechanical side of things is probably more focused on, like, why they were made or what, like, in the time of their creation, as opposed to how are they received now and how do they relate to the history that they're portraying now.
I mean, I'm kind of doing a bit of both, mm-hmm. in terms of that, partly because the games I'm doing are so recent, like, we can't talk about, like, Corinth here.
Like, what did the ancient Greeks think about Corinth, the game?
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah. Corinth came out in 2019.
Right.
Not enough time has passed for me to kind of think about, you know, society in 2019. It's not exactly a far-off period. I have to incorporate it into kind of a modern and recent past and think of it alongside other, like, trends in popular history, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I'm also interested in the relationship, or maybe the split, I guess, and maybe it's not. I'm sure it's not quite a split, but between these sort of, like, more board games, as we would understand them, or card games and dice games, and, like, war gaming, right?
Great question.
Because and I guess you could maybe lump, like, role playing games into that sort of war gaming thing, or maybe that's a third column, whatever. I'm just interested in, like, you, from what you've brought in anyway and what you've spoken about, do seem to be more focused on the sort of, like, board game as opposed to war game thing. But
yeah, I mean, that's mostly because I only have so much time to complete a thesis.
Sure. You could probably play a war game for the entire length of the time you're supposed to be writing your thesis, right? Like, some of those go on forever.
I might be. I mean, my D&D campaign is not ending anytime soon.
Yeah.
But, and I also play Magic the Gathering, which is, again, sort of beyond the scope of my thesis, but I'm going to keep playing it.
The games you're playing are more meant to be completed in, like, one day or a couple of hours, right?
Yeah, these are the games that you play for D&D people out there. These are the games you play when half your party can't make it to the sitting and the rest of you still want to hang out.
Yeah.
Another question I had was, is all of this work leading to you possibly interested in creating your own game yourself?
I would love to. The truth is, I don't have any artistic skills, so I would have to hire someone. And I would probably want someone to consult on the mechanics, because I am very terrible at math. I nearly failed all of my my math and science Brett's courses back in undergrad, and doing them was a huge struggle.
I know how you feel exactly.
So you just need a team.
Yeah, exactly. If I could get together a squad and put something together, I have some cool ideas.
Yeah, it sounds like the reason why I review movies instead of making them, because my artistic ability is just not that high.
Yeah, I could be like I could come up with, like, the concept for a game. It's not really my main focus right now. I'm more interested in playing and analyzing things that other people have done, but you never know.
Yeah, you know, who never knows where the tides will turn, and with your research, you could probably end up coming up with a game that combines a bunch of games. So
that's true, or filling a gap in the market. Like, mm-hmm. there are eras and characters who I don't see portrayed in games, and I could create something to bridge that.
It's the perks of being an expert in a field.
Oh, thanks.
Do you have any examples of characters or eras that you think are underserved, underrepresented?
Women.
Sure, yeah.
Specifically women from recorded history.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of, like, anonymous female figures who show up in games. Like, the merchants in Corinth are kind of imaginary. They are women, but they don't have names or anything. There's some random female citizens in Downfall of Pompeii. Most of the time, when there are, like, named characters who you can play as or who influence the game in some way, they are men.
Or usually, Cleopatra.
Yeah, or Cleopatra. There's a few Cleopatra things out there.
Yeah.
This is interestingly not true in mythology-based stuff. There's so many